Welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD, where successful San Diego leaders share their stories of leading beyond profit and are using the influence of business to positively change the companies and communities we all work and live in. I'm your host, Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership. We unlock the power of organizations and teams to overcome tough challenges, seize new opportunities, and turn bold ideas into real-world results through strategic planning, retreats, and team workshops. We want to thank our collaborative community of business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Cause San Diego, and Be Local. We're all focused on impacting our community of San Diego through the work they do as business leaders. Welcome to the show. Many years ago, there was a panel sharing some business insights at Spire. Today's guest was one of those panelists. I just remember this guy was speaking my love language of purposeful leadership. I have to admit, I've been stalking him on LinkedIn ever since, but today, here he is in the studio. Reid Carr, welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
As CEO and founder, Reid provides strategic direction and leadership for Red Door Interactive, a data and insight-driven advertising agency headquartered in San Diego with an office in Denver, Colorado, and people in many locations as well. His role is to uphold the company's core values and make sure we have the right people doing the right things with the right tools to help their clients meet their objectives. Reid, it's awesome to have you here today, hear your story, learn about the Red Door Interactive, and yeah.
Yeah, always love sharing it.
So I was kind of taken by this tagline I saw on your website.
Yep.
Fiercely independent and staying that way.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
So what's behind that statement? Is there kind of part of the higher purpose and your why, or what's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, once we made that statement and decided that that's how we wanted to operate as an independent. So, you know, in our industry, and maybe people don't always realize that there's a lot of what's called holding companies that are out there. And so public companies that own a bunch of agencies. And so it was something that we wanted to counteract, and rather than be out there kind of seen as an entity for sale, we said, what would we need to do and how would we operate if we were going to sustain ourselves without being part of that bigger ecosystem? So it guides a lot of the decisions that we make and have made now for many years since we made that statement, which includes the kinds of clients we work on, how we operate as it relates to our people, and so on. So, you know, fiercely independent was something that I think I've now seen a lot of people start to adapt that vernacular as well. But again, I think it's a way to operate that we feel pretty confident in.
Ring my bell, because I'm like an 8 on the Enneagram, if you're familiar with that. And I'm like, I don't want to be controlled. So the idea of fiercely independent, like, yeah, man, let's do it.
Yep.
I love that. So maybe give us a little insight as to what you guys do there.
So we focus on customer acquisition for clients. So, you know, you think about it in terms of, we have a lot of larger brands that are out there trying to win market share or grow in all sorts of different environments. We've been around for 23 years, so we've certainly seen our share of economic cycles. But in all cases, they're trying to bring more customers into the fold, work within their construct. So we have many of our clients are parts of conglomerates or kind of multi-channel in the sense that they've got like a higher ed with many different departments or healthcare hospitals, or like I said, kind of conglomerates like an SC Johnson or a Titleist or something like that with many brands underneath that fold. So they also have to market internally, right? So that you can prioritize, make sure that they're spending their money wisely. And so within all of that, we're helping our brands identify what that those marketing channels should be in a multi-channel way. You know, as we've all evolved in this industry, I mean, I started, there was about a few different ways, 5 different ways to reach a consumer. And now there's, you know, hundreds of different, hundreds or thousands, right? Not to mention all the data infrastructure and technology that we need. So within all of that as well, we think about the tech scaffolding that needs to wrap around the clients that we have, to make sure that we're getting the data that we need, can make the decisions we need to make, react quickly to changing environments. So within all of that, at the end of the day, it's how do we help our clients attract more customers, do so authentically for what that brand can deliver, because that's what ultimately retains customers as well, and then match those back up to the overall business objectives, whether it's a, like I said, conglomerate where there's competing priorities, competing budgets, or, you know, other entities that are going to be out there that, you know, never have enough resources to do what they want to do. So we make sure that we help them prioritize as well.
I love that. The word authenticity. Yeah. Who are you really? What are you really doing over here?
Oh, yeah.
What can we count on you for?
You know, it's interesting how the industry has evolved. I mean, there was a not that long ago where brands did not need to be authentic in the sense that the old joke of that one being that, you know, the doctors that were smoking smoking and advocating for cigarettes or whatever we knew that was not healthy, because brands could say what they wanted to and a consumer would really never know what was happening kind of behind the scenes. It didn't really take that much longer for things like, you know, ratings and reviews and LinkedIn and a lot of other tools out there that you start to know what's kind of peel back the curtain a bit.
Just a little more informed than we used to be.
Absolutely. And I think it's been a great thing, in many ways.
So talk a little about, how did you get into this?
I fell in love with advertising out of high school. I was really looking for something that satisfied the aspect of the consumer part of things, like the psychology of it, writing, creativity, design. So I got into advertising as the craft. So I think a lot of times we wrap marketing and talk about them synonymously, but really the advertising component of it is a subset of the price, product, place, promotion. It's really that promotion part of it is, you know, how do you tell a brand story? How do you reach the right people? What motivates people, whether it's from a visual standpoint or that kind of clever connection to people's emotions? So that's the thing I fell in love with back then. I went to University of Oregon in the advertising program there, one of the best programs in the world at the time. Still would think that as well, and fell deeper in love with it in that way. And so I started my career in Los Angeles at an agency called TBWA Chiat Day, which at the time was famous for the, you know, Taco Bell Chihuahua, the Think Different campaign for Apple, Energizer Bunny. Absolutely. So it was kind of around some of the best work that really had a connection to culture, which is we're in an interesting place right now. I think advertising back then, if you remember, you could, you know, a Super Bowl commercial like Budweiser Bullfrogs, everyone knew it, or the Waza, you know, some of those things that are out there, it played a role in culture. I think it doesn't happen as much today because of the fragmentation, but it's still rooted in finding insights and finding things that resonate with folks. And so as I evolved from that heavily creative environment, the world around us was changing, where we have, you know, data and analytics and a lot of other things that says, is this actually working? Is it moving the needle? That's where ultimately kind of led to two things, which is one, I didn't want to live in LA anymore. I love San Diego. So it came down here, and two is starting Red Door with the idea that we were going to use data and insights, and wherever that consumer is going to be, we're going to adapt our strategy and tactics to reach them, which was new at the time, the idea of integration and real integration. So there were agencies at the time that were doing or called integrated agencies, but they just were like three completely separate departments trying to sell to the same, you know, marketing stakeholder. Whereas I really wanted to get tactics working together. So you have to have tactical expertise. So who knows how to manage paid media, or who knows how to do search engine optimization, all these little, at the time, new things that were coming out. You had to be a subject matter expert on those. But at the same token is you had to have brand consistency, similar voice, regardless of the tactics and channels that we were using. And that was what was so fun and fascinating to me. And that's why I started Red Door 23 years ago to do that. And now continuing to evolve that in a world that now is we're getting into AI and other tools out there that the end of the day is what's, you know, we bring up authenticity. What's going to matter to the consumer? You know, are these good quality products that meet those needs? And then how do you put those two things together?
So what's your superpower? Are you a creative? Are you the integrator? What role do you play?
You know, I think
that's... What's your job? Maybe there's a role you play, but here's what I really like to do in life.
Well,
what do you love to do,
Reed? Yeah. There's a couple components to that. And I think that's one of the things when you're an organization, a fiercely independent, mid-sized agency that does a lot of things for a lot of different brands, you do have to wear a lot of hats and different perspectives. So bringing things together. So, you know, we use StrengthsFinder, if you're familiar with that.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. So being an arranger is part of what I'm doing, but yeah, you know, thumbs up on that. And then
number two on my hit list.
Yeah. Well, that's number two as well.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah. There you go.
You got strategic in there somewhere.
Strategic. Yeah. But by individualization is number one. And arranger is number two for me. And those are two things I think I bring to bear in a lot of ways, is seeing things in, you know, as they are, those individuals and the key pieces, whether it's individuals as people or brands. And I think of brands in a lot of ways as people with personalities, if we can. And so how do we illuminate those and maximize those and then put them in all the right places? And so I think between those two functions, that is, you know, plays a hand in how I run the organization at a leadership level, but also on the creative side is, what are we looking for? What's that insight? What really is motivating? Again, there's the brand side of the things, the client, and then the consumer who we're trying to reach, and what motivates them and what's their truth, and how do we connect those pieces together if they should connect? And again, that's, we don't want to sell something that people don't want or aren't right for them. And I think that's important to us in our client selection as well, is we work with great brands that are really trying to do the right thing for the customers that they have.
Do you have a bit of a sorting process or something you do to ensure you're working with the right clients?
We do. And it's complex in some respects. And we have a scoring system for sure. Because, you know, what I would say is it's not our job just to win new clients. I think a lot of people think of it that way. For us, it's important for us to win stalwart clients, clients that are going to be with us for a long time. You know, you could say that that's the right way to do things that, you know, just kind of feels right. But I'll say at a practical level, that makes business sense because bringing a new client, it doesn't work well. You know, keep bringing on more people and then letting them go because you don't have the right fit. You don't make money that way. Nobody's happy that way. Right. The clients aren't happy the way. And so at the end of the day is it's really important that we get that fit right. And it's not just at a metrics level, like are they a certain size or it's a budget or any of that. Those are certainly factors. Like, do they have enough money to do the things that they want to accomplish through us? That's a factor for sure. But other parts of it is, you know, is there a culture that's going to fit with ours? Do they believe in multi-channel? Do they believe in some of these other things that are going to matter, not just to their consumers, but certainly to our people who are going to dedicate themselves so much to the brands that they're working on?
So you're truly looking for a long-term relationship.
Absolutely.
This is not like, oh, let's just win something, make some money and move on. This is like, no, let's be a long-term relationship. And it seems like it makes a lot of sense as well in this business you guys are in.
It does. And I think that plays a role as in that, you know, fiercely independent that we started with. So big holding company says, hey, win new clients, show me new clients, new logos. And that is a major factor in illustrating some kind of growth. For us, it's not growth for growth's sake. We want to grow because I think that creates opportunity for our people, but we want to grow through winning new clients that stay with us for a long time, that we build another new client that stays with us for a long time and another one that stays with us. And that's for us as a longer term vision for growth. That's not going to come as when one-off pops.
Right. And if you're successful, they're growing.
Exactly.
So if they're growing, then you get to grow with them, right?
Yeah.
So there's the win-win.
Yeah.
Like you got skin in the game, right?
Yeah. And I think a lot of times clients may not realize how much skin we do have in that game. We hire these people, we dedicate ourselves to bringing the right people in. And then they work on the clients that we can bring in. But the reality is if they don't have work to do, we're still paying for them to be there. And then when they work on the clients that we do win, we're, you know, effectively paying them in advance for the work they're going to do. And the clients then pay us. And there is a much deeper than just skin in the game. I mean, there's a true emotional connection to these brands. You know, I realize that, you know, you run out and start buying all those products, you get proud of them and excited about it. And I think clients feel that when you've got people working on the business that care about it. And I hope that our clients always feel that we care that much about them as much as they do or more.
I love that. Where did the name come from? Red Door. There's got to be a story behind that.
There is. You know, it's Red Door Interactive. A couple components of this is any good agency, they write a creative brief when they're working on a piece of creative. In this case, it was a name. And so we wanted a name to reflect a few things. One is if you think about this back in, we started in 2002. So roughly 2001, we were dreaming this up. You know, a lot of people were trying to create words to get a domain name. So it was whatever.com and it was really kind of wonky stuff that was largely not memorable. So one thing that, if you think about the psychology layer of this, is people remember tangible objects. So a red door is a tangible object. It's something that they can associate a memory with, and they're going to remember the name better as a result. Two is we wanted something that reflected communication, open communication. So the idea of a door. We wanted something that was going to say friendliness or something, openness, that make people feel comfortable when they work with us. And we kind of triangulated on the name Red Doors, that part of it, kind of going through that process of what's going to make this, you know, what's a tangible object that make people feel comfortable, people feel like there's open communication. And so we always said the kind of the idea with the red doors, you know, it's going to be the house with the Halloween candy, the best Halloween candy. It's the house that wants you there. They've painted that door red. We later learned wasn't part of it, but like, you know, a sign of prosperity in Asian cultures. So there's a number of different factors that kind of made that work. But the great thing about a creative brief is when you say, here's all the stuff we want this to accomplish, and you get a name or a word or something like that, and you go, you know what, this checks all the box, we can move on. We found it. We can move on. Because I think naming, a lot of times people don't realize, is it a lot of times doesn't sound right or feel right until you make that the brand. It's not the name. Like Nike is not the name. Nike is the culture and all the attributes of it that make it Nike. And same, we believe, with Red Door as well. So that's the part of Red Door. And then the interactive part was really about the tipping point of, we were kind of broadcast was one to many. Brands did not have to dialogue or even interact with their customers. So we decided and settled on the word interactive because we wanted brands. I firmly believe that companies and marketers and brands and everyone in an organization should interact with their customers. And at that point, you know, again, broadcast was, I could put something out there and never hear again. I just watch sales come in. And we're at that tipping point. At that point, it was pre-social media or anything. We're saying, you know, brands are going to have to start to engage. And that was the idea with the interactive part as well. It was kind of a direction in philosophically to our brands that would say, hey, you need to get out there and you know, press the flesh with the customer.
So you use some of your own tools on you is what you...
Absolutely. You know, you really...
Sometimes people don't do that, right? You don't use your tools. Yeah. It's kind of a...
No, we have to have the discipline to do that. And, you know, if we expect any of this stuff or our clients certainly to believe us, we need to do it ourselves. And we do. That we have our marketing department. We have our marketing strategies. We use many of the ones for ourselves that we believe clients should use as well. And I think oftentimes we'll be ahead of that. You know, clients aren't ready for certain things, but we want to make sure that if we think it's right, we're going to do it ourselves. So we have something to point to. To say, look, no, we believe in this ourselves. We put our money where our mouth is.
Well, one of the things I was drawn to you is the whole idea of the kind of the purposeful leader and kind of the conscious capitalism and all the things associated with this particular podcast. And so I'd love to talk a little bit about your values. I mean, you've grown a sizable organization over the last 20 plus years. I mean, what, 90 folks you got now? So that's a lot of people. And maybe even your story of evolving as a leader. I don't know if out of the box, like, oh, let's have values, or that came with time, but maybe speak a little bit to like your leadership and the values and how that all fits together.
Yeah. So our core values is an interesting process there. So I think we were a couple of years into the business and decided to write, you know, kind of think through that mission, vision, values process. And I realized at that tipping point, when you first start the business, the values of our organization, it's not that they're not there. They're there.
They're always they're there.
They're innate in you because you're the one doing the work. And then I realized when I started having managers managing people doing the work was when we really needed to articulate how did we want to behave and how did we want to do that work. So I started doing the research, mission, vision, values, and I wrote down, worked with my, at the time, the leadership team, and we wrote down, I want to be very precise, and wrote down 8 sentences of these are our values. And then a few years into the business, you know, you introduce the performance evaluations. And classically in there, how are people living up to the core values of the organization? And I would read the input on those that managers would provide. And I realized, I was like, you know what? I don't think anybody remembers the core values. And I was like, that's on me, right? I think
we had a plaque in the lobby. I mean,
right? Yeah.
That's the classic.
And you know, how do I really expect 8 full sentences of like, this is what we're trying to accomplish because I was trying to be so precise. And so I had the managers out for lunch one day and I put 3x5 cards at everybody's spot with a pencil and said, write down our values. And it was just a quick test to like confirm that I was right about this. And so for the most part, everyone got one of our core values, right? Which was, is currently today is 100% jerk free. That's pretty memorable.
People love that one.
We did that one. That was one of the originals. But the rest of them, everyone kind of got some amalgamation of some of the sentences, maybe would get another one, something like that. So then I was like, I got to fix this. And so then I wrote down the core values, inspire, share, evolve, exceed, 100% jerk free. We turned that into a mnemonic, IC 100%. So everyone at the organization knows those. So we did that part. And then that evolved from, you're like, okay, now we can hold people, quote, accountable to these core values. But I also would realize that if we didn't hire by those core values, then these things were not innate in the people. Anyone could live up to core values that they put out there if they're not under any kind of pressure. But if you're under pressure, your values show up. Yes. And if those are not aligned, then you start to have that conflict, the problems. And so then we started back, we completely changed our hiring process and say, like, let's hire by the values. So we think about obviously what skills they need to do the job. They need that. But then the other really critical part is those values and not just saying, oh yeah, they seem like they'll be fine. It's like, we need to hear specific stories for each of these core values. And so that was pretty transformative to the organization, is not just writing them, not just if you can remember them, not just quote, holding people accountable to them, but at the end of the day is hired by them. And the other interesting thing about that, I believe, is then that brings in the real idea of kind of diversity, equity, and inclusion, in the sense that you get people who at that point, these are the things that need to be consistent. Anything else, we want a different perspective. We want people coming through that absolutely inspire, share, evolve, exceed, 100% jerk free. They will have those attributes. But what I didn't want was what we call, and I would see that often, is the quote, bro culture of other organizations, where there was a test. I remember some people say, does that seem like somebody who I could grab a beer with? And that was a consistent, quote, test that people would have. And I was like, then I'm just going to end up with a whole bunch of people like my buddies.
Up there drinking beer together.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not what we want as an organization. As I want people like, look, they have the core skills to do the job. They have these core values. And so if I don't want to go grab a beer with them, but those two components are perfectly aligned, then that is adding critical diversity to the organization that's going to be important to us delivering the kind of work we need to deliver for our clients, because that is a really important part of what we do. And maybe that isn't the same for everyone out there, but for us, for sure, is we need diversity of thought and opinion to come up with new creative, innovative ideas,
right,
which I'd argue anyone should do that. But for us, that is core to our business, is we got to see things from a different perspective. And if I don't have as many possible perspectives as I can, and they don't feel like they can share that perspective, then we're not going to produce the work we need to produce for our clients. So
like we're kind of laughing about the strength finders, you know, having similar, we're hitting it off, right? Yeah. We see the world the same way, but that's not going to give you a very creative solutions, right?
Right. And that's why something like strength finders is so great, is we don't hire by strength finders, but when you start to get those out there and you see what everybody's strengths are, now you really, that goes back to the individualization in a ranger, is, you know, who'd be really good on doing this thing is that person because of this particular strength that they have. Exactly. So documenting that and having a dialogue about that, you really get people operating with strengths, and then they're just like, you know, consistent core values. So you know what you get. They've got the skills to do the job, and they're really passionate about something that maybe I'm not as into, is now you got a real team.
So using it in the hiring process, is it also part of the review process? I mean, you guys kind of bring that in?
The values part?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely part. So core values are certainly part of the hiring process, and core values are absolutely part of the reviews.
How do you do reviews? Because that's always a big challenge. You know, the old school annual, you know, here's your thing. Here's the five things you should improve at, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a strength finder's approach, right? That's kind of the opposite direction.
So. Yeah. So, you know, we have two times a year, but we also, so thankfully now software and tools that help manage this process. And we have a fantastic team that runs all of this stuff for us. So our employee experience team, again, a lot of people.
Employee experience team.
Yeah.
We have to talk more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about HR or something like that. And we think about, well, how do we create the best possible employee experience? You know, we have that customer experience elsewhere, is like our most important customer is going to be our employees, right? So we call it the employee experience. How do we contribute to their experience, which includes IT? You know, think about the number one tool that any of us use, certainly in our environment, is our computer. And if that thing's not working the way it needs to work, you don't have the software that you need to do your job effectively, you're not doing your best work, you're frustrated, or you're spending a whole bunch of time because we wouldn't buy a piece of software for you that would help you do your best work. So anyway, so within that overall ecosystem, I believe in this idea of employee experience and how do we facilitate that to make sure that everyone is able to do their best possible work and nothing stands in their way of doing that. But going back to the reviews, yeah, we do it a couple times a year. We have a platform that we use that has your kind of the structure for your one-to-ones and your ability to kind of move the ball on the goals that you have. So, I mean, thankfully in this day and age, it's not just sitting down and hoping that you had your review with your manager, but we do have the questions you go through, 360s, that part of it once a year. So you are getting that perspective.
Oh, that's good.
And so I know there's a lot of different philosophies on it. That's just, we have it, embraced that. We have consistent check-ins with people, kind of know how they're feeling about things. And then in the background of all of that, kind of that, I would call this almost like a manager review as well, which is ongoing feedback for the organization. So we use a tool called Office Vibe. We've been used for many years, asking kind of the pillars of engagement. And so every employee surveyed pretty much consistently, like 5 questions every week.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, helps us gauge kind of overall feeling of the organization. And that's kind of a review of certainly of me, of the employee experience, of managers, but also gives us some directional things that we can go, hey, you know, there's something we can work on here, whether it's in a department level or organizationally. And we use that feedback very consistently to help continue and make the organization healthier.
It's kind of interesting. So the DOGE process of what's the 5 things you did for me this week? It's the how did we do this week? What are your 5 things, right? So I love that.
For sure.
A little different mindset about that. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I know I kind of preparing for our interview was looking you up and doing a little research, and I saw a video in your organization doing a food show.
Oh, yeah. That was a while ago. That's funny.
Yeah, it was some years ago.
Yeah, that was when Chopped.
It caught my attention, though. I sat through the whole thing.
Oh, man. We have some fun. I mean, that's what you have. An organization of people who are come up with, you know, they see what trends are happening, have some fun. People lean in and say, yeah, let's give it a shot. So, yeah, we did an episode of Red Door Chopped. Yeah, a while back, and that was pretty funny.
Yeah, it might have been like 7-8 years ago or something.
Oh, yeah.
But it was good.
Yeah.
So you've grown this organization. You now have another office location. That's a challenge. And then obviously you got people working in different locations. So how do you manage this sort of remote scenario? I think that's a big challenge for a lot of leaders.
Yeah. So we've always been, since day one, hybrid as an organization. It was a philosophy. So
never, this was not something new for you.
No. And it's been interesting because it was such a huge transformation post-COVID. And for us, I always felt be where you need to be to do the work you need to do. And so be conscious of what it is you need to get done that day. Where's going to be the best place to do that work? Who do you need involved? And have adult conversations with people if you need them in the office to work. Plan ahead, because we all should plan and we think about our schedules in those ways. So then having us evolve into different locations and people working elsewhere was pretty natural at that point, because we've been doing it for so long that every meeting used to have a call-in number. We didn't have video back then. We didn't have Teams. So as all these tools and technologies kind of evolve, we're like, oh my gosh, look at this now. We canceled the teleconference numbers and, could use Teams, we used Skype prior to that. So it was, for it to be a shock to people, we just kind of evolved as this whole space did. The locations that we build out, I make sure there are places people want to come. That was another big thing. We don't want people to have to come. We want them to want to come. And so we make sure that we do big events and bring people together so they kind of feel like what it's like to have a big groups together. Like I said, the adult conversations, if you have a brainstorming meeting, you think it would be best done in person, you plan ahead, make the request. We use employee templates for meeting invites that say, is this in-person required? Is this
a fair amount of structure we've put in place here to make this all work seamlessly and make sure we're not wasting our time?
Well, I'm a big believer in, if you're going to operate in chaos, you need to have structure. You cannot meet chaos with chaos. So we put a lot of structure in place to give a lot of guideposts for people what's going to work effectively. But again, because all these people can tend to be remote or hybrid, or they are in other places, making sure that people are conscious of the people who are not in the room, because I don't want them to feel like they can't participate. We forget about them. So it's been pretty disciplined within any meeting room, had the list of remember who these participants are, which is one of the things is a remote meeting monitor. So if you're in the physical room with more people than in other places, you have to remember, for example, hey, everyone, remote meeting monitor here, but we're all talking over each other, and I'm pretty sure that so-and-so can't hear, and someone just calls that out and go, oh, yep, okay, one at a time, or things like that.
Like kind of an assigned role coming into the meeting. That's
so it's part of the template. We have people, the presenter, what's the expectation? People are participating, what's the expectation? And then, who's going to be the remote meeting monitor for this one? And a lot of times that can be, some of this stuff is kind of all, you forget to fill out the role or whatever, but people know like, oh, hey, I'm going to be the remote meeting monitor for a second here. And hey, I think we're talking over each other. Or, hey, people are conscious of, thankfully, the technology has evolved and they've got the little hand raise tool, or you can elicit kind of that emotion through the little reactions and stuff. And you see the little hearts go and the claps go, when you used to feel like, oh, that silence, they're not paying attention, but you see some of those reactions. And that's part of the culture, being comfortable with the chat going on and people chiming in that way. So I think the culture, because we've had this for so long, it's a pretty natural environment. I think that creates cross kind of border, so to speak, in terms of, states and whatever culture that makes that consistent, and then bringing people together when we can.
You have a video on requirement?
No.
No? Okay.
No. And I understand that. I mean, I think that you can put it in there and say, hey, not in person, but video preferred, and people conscious about that too. I think, again, the request is, hey, I'm going to do this long presentation, and it's this one-to-many situation, and it's empathy, right? You know what it feels like to present to a blank screen,
right?
So you're going to lose some energy for me. So I'm going to ask real quick if everyone can put their cameras on, if that works for you. And you'll get most people, and some people are like, hey, I can't because of
something, or driving or doing whatever.
Or, look, man, if they want to go for a walk when we're doing a presentation like that, and then you know that they don't actually have to look at the screen, that's fantastic. If that's how they pay attention best, which I'm like that. If I go for a walk and listening somewhere or talking to someone, I'm way more focused. And think about how many people are sitting there start to, drift off. They see a Teams message pop up, or that one email comes in that they were waiting. And like, are they really paying attention? So I can throw my phone in my pocket. I'm not on camera because it's in my pocket. And like, hey, just let you know, I'm going to go for a walk while we talk about this. And I will pay attention much better if we do it that way.
way healthier.
I love you. You have this interesting line of structure.
Yeah.
We're going to put a lot of structure around this, but at the same time, we want to give you a lot of freedom because we're a creative agency, right? We want people to really show up as themselves. That's what we hired you to do, but we're going to do this in some defined way.
Yeah.
I love that.
Absolutely. And again, it is really important that people feel like they can have a conversation, like adult conversation, which is, hey, that meeting didn't work for me, you know, after the meeting, because of it would have been nice if you would have been in, you know, I realized I didn't give you that advance warning, but next time, maybe we should do that. Remind, you know, little things like that. It's a important part of our relationships. And so like, for example, I bring up our IC 100% core values. We have adverbs that go along with that as 100% jerk-free candidly, for example, is what we don't want from someone is like 100% jerk-free means, you know, just going along like, oh, I have a different opinion, but you know, I don't want to rock the boat. Part of being that friend and that relationship and a colleague is to be candid. Just be thoughtful about how you do that.
Right.
Because you don't want to be a jerk about it, but you say, look, I think in this case, like I wanted to let you know that this would have been more helpful. And was, how do we figure this out and make it better next time?
So how are you figuring this all out? This is amazing stuff, Reed. I mean, are you attending something, reading things, or what's...
No, I mean, I think...
How's this evolving for you?
Well, I mean, it evolved, I think getting into one... You know, starting the business and having no idea what I was doing. So what is it you need to know? And so I remember early on was reading business magazines because I just didn't know basic business terms.
Right.
So I'd go to a conference and people would talk about something, you know, like, oh yeah, and the EBITDA and that kind of, I'd be like, I don't know what that is. You know, I need to learn these things and catch up quick. And then I evolved to books of like, okay, now I'm starting to know that I'm missing certain things that I want to learn. Then I went, so I'm voraciously reading, going from the business magazines to the business books. Then I joined organizations like Vistage and EO, and I'm in YPO. And that becomes a little more curation of like, hey, you know, I was directing, I knew I didn't know certain things. And there's a point in time you don't know what you don't know. So the more you participate and you hear what other people are going through, or they curate something in like a Vistage environment where they would drop something on and say, hey, we're going to do a session on this. Go, I've never even given that any thought.
Yeah.
Pick up what you can from that. Comfortable, like just like any artist will steal, right? So you steal these ideas, you start to make them your own. What works for us? And I always believe that any of these organizations is very much a recipe. There is no perfect, you know, it's like a dose of that or dose of this. You like more salt than I do, and it's fine. Your version is your version and mine's another one. And so as you kind of build out that composition, how does it evolve over time with culture and the people and the things that are happening around us? So just keeping my eyes open for that. And then now I'd say my focus is much more on our people and what they're paying attention to. You know, as you get bigger, there's people always ask like, well, how do you keep up on trends in our industry or whatever? It's like, I've got, you know, 100 people who are doing that and they are synthesizing it and figuring out how now
you're,
it's...
You're the conductor now, right?
You're not playing
the instrument. You know, how do I make music over here?
Well, I mean, some of it is on the audience, right? I mean, you sit there and you're like, wow. I mean, when I was doing the work and, you know, you look at it and go, okay, I'm doing these five different jobs. I'm not doing any of them perfectly. I'm doing them pretty good. And then you get someone who's really focused on one of those things and you see where they take it and you're like, oh man, I was nowhere near that. And so then you kind of start sitting back and you're like, there is that certainly conductor component of it. And then there's some of it you can just sit back in awe and go like, I'm going to absorb as much as I can and synthesize as much of it as I can to kind of, I have to put some sort of direction to the organization as well as things evolve. And so how do I kind of soak it up until there's a point in time where like, okay, do we need to shift on something? We are at a transformational point here with AI and some tools like that, and got to soak it up a little bit. And have I seen this pattern before? Aspects of it for sure, with the, you know, the web taking off and different kinds of browsers. Is that similar to this, or is it going to show up in a different way? So, you know, I'm still kind of soaking all that up. And I know people talk about how fast you have to react to things, but it's that idea of how deliberate can we be and how precise can we be as we move through and evolve the business in ways that are more thoughtful than just reactionary.
Yeah, certainly that was a question I wanted to ask around AI, you know, as a leader, especially in the space that you're in. What do you see, you know, and how are you leading with this?
So I keep talking about three different dimensions of this is better, faster, cheaper. And I think the faster and cheaper parts of it, I think those are the table stakes of what is something we do and how do I do it faster? What is something we do and how do we do it cheaper? Those two things often go obviously hand in hand when we're very kind of human and resource based. But the third one I think is more inspiring and interesting for a lot of people, which is how to make things better. Now, how do we make our work better as a result of these tools? Now, there's dimensions that we'll fold in of, we didn't used to be able to do this because it was too cost prohibitive, but now the costs have come down. So that would be a function of obviously cheap, making something cheaper or faster. But ultimately, the thought process is we've got to use these tools to make things better. Can I get a better outcome for our clients? And it doesn't always mean that that's going to make it cheaper by using these tools either. It might make it more complicated, but boy, you know, if you add this layer to it, you're going to get something a lot more transformative. There was a campaign, we didn't do this, one I use quite often as an example that I think is makes something more powerful as a result of using tools like AI. And I want to say it was in like Minnesota or something, and it was around fentanyl. You know, a campaign trying to get people to obviously avoid fentanyl and realizing the insight. So a critical component of insight being a lot of times they get it from a friend. And it wasn't that they went to a drug dealer and got something. Is their friend, you know, say, hey, I'm having this back pain. A friend says, hey, I got something for you. So they didn't know where their friend got it and they trust their friend. So how do you change that dimension? And so what they did, the campaign was they worked with families of people who had died from fentanyl overdoses and got video and audio of those people. And then got approval to do this and gave them their last words. And so you saw the person in their voice as they were saying, hey, I didn't know I was having this back pain. I talked to my friend. And there's a version of that you could do without AI that would be cheaper, which is, hey, this is an actor portrayal. This is something. But when you actually use the real person who was like, I didn't know, you know, and the way they would do it, I mean, it had to have been heartbreaking something for the real, family,
yeah. Yeah.
But it was real. I think that's a really interesting example of better that actually is more expensive to do, a lot harder to do, but man, does that make that much more powerful? And I think there's a lot of things we're still yet to do using these tools that are going to take a lot of effort, a lot of thought. And I think that's one thing, by the way, a lot of businesses and clients certainly don't realize is, hey, this is supposed to make things cheaper. And you're like, it takes a lot to figure it out first. Yeah. And then once we do, it can certainly make things cheaper. But there's a lot of dreaming left to do using these tools. And that's where I'm most excited by the tools. And I think that's the thing that I want, rather than people be afraid of, is like, how do we get inspired by it? And again, in the background, yeah, there's going to be things that make things faster and cheaper. That's fine. And we need to do those things, but let's really focus on better.
Yeah. I'm pretty excited here this week. I'm part of an organization called Exchange out of Ohio, which I'm a facilitator. That's what I do for a living. And they're having a whole conversation, a little 3-hour event on the interface of AI and conscious facilitation. So I'm very excited to see what these guys are coming up with. They're kind of the thought leaders, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, looking forward to it.
It'll be interesting. I mean, it is definitely going to change work. It'll change jobs. And I think there's a reason for certain people to be afraid of it, which is unfortunate. Meanwhile, what can we do around them to help them adapt?
So there are a lot of crazy things going on in this world. What are you most optimistic about, Reed?
Well, I mean, I think we kind of just segued a little bit from that. I think there's some things that will help us do better work, bring some of the better work down to brands that couldn't afford. So focusing obviously advertising component of it, brands that couldn't afford some of the better work that they can now because the tools can allow them to do interesting photography that they couldn't afford before or do better research that they couldn't do before to have better insights. Because I think a challenge that we've had in our industry, I do feel like it has gotten so cluttered with mediocre work because really anyone can do it to some degree, and meaning anyone can take a photo, put words on it, stick it anywhere they want for, I mean, pretty much as cheap as it gets. And I think then it's over and then let the quote algorithm do its thing and people react to it and certain people buy and therefore it works to some degree, but it certainly doesn't make the experience for most consumers, their kind of daily experience, any better. Kind of like I had talked about earlier where you had these spots that, you know, people would reflect on and laugh about and remember because it was part of culture, not that far off from sitcoms and shared experiences that we'd have back then. I think we're going to find some more of that coming back. I hope we will find that. And I also am optimistic about people getting back in the real world a bit and having shared experiences. I see some of the trends now of bars that make you put your phone away. And I think hopefully are craving authentic connections with people such that we communicate better with each other. And I think we'll see a lot more of that. That doesn't mean there won't be other ends of the spectrum that are kind of remain the same. But meanwhile, I think we've got a lot of opportunity had to kind of get better connected. And I think there seems to be a cultural desire to do so.
actually was struck. I think it was 2 weekends ago. My wife and I were at Concerts in the Park in Pacific Beach, and we're actually holding down a tent at the top of the hill at Mount Kate Sessions Park. So I can see out like hundreds and hundreds of people. And all of a sudden I looked at my wife, I go, look, no one's on their phone. Everybody's sitting around on blankets and eating. And there was like, no, seriously, there was like no one on their phone. I'm like, it was like a weird feeling. So it's kind of cool. It's possible. It's definitely possible. It is.
And I think you see it with some of the younger generation too. They're starting to recognize it as well. So that's the hope I have, is we put some of the devices away when the time is right and really have authentic connections with one another that yield then the communication that we all kind of crave and hope for.
That's certainly a lot of what I'm trying to do in my business. It's all about collaboration. How do you get people in a room and start having great conversations, right?
That's right.
Solving big problems. We got to put a bow on this, man. Big question for you. What's the big idea? If people didn't remember anything else, we want to remember, Reed.
What I'd hope anyone would think about is to remember the human, right? Remember the people, remember emotion, remember connection. I think that that's going to be, it's rooted in leadership. It's rooted in bringing people together to create great work. It's rooted in and can empower brands to reach their consumers and connect with them emotionally and authentically. So at the end of the day, for as much time as we talk about technology and AI and computers and whatever, at the end of the day, it's going to come back down to the human and the human connection.
Love that. Well, thanks for coming in. Yeah. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your story. And some of the insights on how you're leading your organization, because you're doing some really cutting edge stuff there. But
well, I love doing it here in person. It's nice to be in studio.
Yeah, right there, right?
That's right.
We're not Zooming this. This is the real deal. Yeah, I love it.
Perfect.
Well, that's our show for today. And if you enjoyed it, please subscribe, comment, and most importantly, share the podcast with a friend. Again, special thanks to our collaborative community of San Diego business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Be Local, and Cause San Diego. We're all using the influence of business to positively impact our very own community of San Diego. I'm Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership saying, until next time, go do what you do. Go do what you do best, for we're all counting on you.